All right, I'm going to interrupt your dessert, if that's okay. I guess you guys are on dessert now. Go ahead and get started, because we've got a lot to talk about. And first of all, let me just say thank you to, I can see over here, Lee Otis, who has really put together, once again, a really impressive panel, just like last term, to go over some of the important cases of the term, look at trends, talk about particular justices, one in particular. And so I think that really we should all start this discussion by giving Lee a big round of applause for putting all this together. And thank you guys all for coming. I just happened to notice the date today, which I don't know if any of you guys have realized, but it was exactly 3 years ago today that we got the bombshell announcement that Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was going to be retiring from the Supreme Court after 24 years on the bench, which, of course, set in motion a chain of events that none of us could have expected, certainly predicted, and really got us to where we are today, looking back at this term and certainly talking a little bit about last term, how this court is, of course, so different now in so many different areas with Justice Alito taking Justice O'Connor's place on the bench. And also just the role that the presidents have. I know some of our panelists are going to be talking about the election in the court. So I think the timing today, 3 years ago, we were all not quite this relaxed when we were thinking about the Supreme Court. It was quite a shock. I'm going to introduce our panelists. They're going to talk about, they've kind of come up with topics of interest to them, and they're going to talk for 5 or 6 or 7 minutes, and I'm supposed to cut them off. They go on too long, so I have like a baseball bat down here. But and then we're going to have kind of a back and forth and questions about, you know, whatever you guys might want to talk about. So I'll just go in order down the row. First of all, you're going to hear from – are you going to go first? Are we going in this order? Okay. All right. So first of all, you're going to hear from Nelson Lund, who is the Patrick Henry Professor of Constitutional Law and Second Amendment at George Mason School of Law. He's written widely – I'm sure you guys all know this – on the Constitution, Second Amendment, filed an amicus brief in the Heller case, obviously one of the major, major cases, not only the term, but of the decade that we got last week. He also clerked for Justice O'Connor. Next to Nelson is Ted Cruz, who has just gone over to Morgan Lewis as a partner in their litigation practice, focusing, of course, on the court. He was the Solicitor General for the state of Texas before that. And I am told that he is the only lawyer in recent history. Is this true? To argue multiple times wearing cowboy boots?
I suspect it is.
I don't know. What would your former boss, Chief Justice William Rehnquist, have said about that?
I don't think he would have approved.
Anyway, and then let's see. Next to Ted is Charles Rothfeld, who is counsel at Mayor Brown. And an interesting thing about Charles, he represented King Henry V, very young. He doesn't look that old, does he? When the king was sued by Falstaff in a proceeding put on by the Washington Shakespeare Theater. And why this is of note is Justice Ginsburg was on the panel that decided the case. And Charles is probably the only lawyer who has been able to threaten a justice with beheading if she ruled the wrong way. Charles has also argued 22 cases before the Supreme Court, and I don't think you went that far when you were in the First Street building. And he clerked for Justice Blackmun. And next to Charles is Orrin Kerr, who is a professor at George Washington University Law School. And I'm sure all of you guys know Orrin, or feel like you know Orrin, because he is a frequent and a very thoughtful contributor to the Volokh conspiracy. And he clerked for Justice Kennedy. And next to Orrin is Rachel Brand, who has just joined Wilmer Hill in the litigation department, focusing on government affairs and national security issues. And before Rachel joined Wilmer Hill, she was over at DOJ, where she headed up the Office of Legal Policy and was very deeply involved in coordinating and handling the judicial nominations for President Bush. And, of course, that included Roberts and Alito, prepping both of them for their respective confirmation hearings. And she also clerked for Justice Kennedy. And next to Rachel at the very end, certainly last but certainly not least, is Tom Goldstein, who's head of Akin Gump's Washington, D.C. litigation practice and co-head of the firm-wide Supreme Court practice. Tom has argued 18 cases before the court, appears to be involved in almost every single case up there. And he's also kind of changed the way that we monitor the court because he's behind the SCOTUS blog, which gives us all, you know, kind of the go-to place when you're looking for court news. And you just started doing live blogging on decision days, which makes the people in my office very happy because, you know, we're kind of trapped in the courtroom and can't really say what's going on. So those are our fantastic panelists, all of which are going to talk about very fascinating things about this term, which, of course, looked in many ways a lot different than last term. You know, when we were here last year, it looked like a sharply new conservative court. And we were talking about Justice O'Connor being replaced by Justice Alito and all those decisions last year that we saw really go the other way on a number of hot button, if you'll think back, social issues, whether it was partial birth abortion, school desegregation, 5-4 decisions with the court appearing to be on a pretty firm conservative course. But as you heard here last year, many people thought that that was going to be a little aberration and that this term might look different because the lineup of cases this term was very different. And that is really what happened. So why don't we start with Nelson, and we'll go down the line. And Nelson is going to talk about the Heller case, obviously one that was 5-4. I don't know if that would have been different if Justice O'Connor had been on the bench, but take it away.
Thank you very much, and thanks also to Lee and the Federalist Society. Heller was the most high-visibility decision of the term, and with good reason. For the first time in our history, the Supreme Court clearly held that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to keep firearms for self-defense. The court struck down D.C.'s handgun ban, as well as a safe storage law that prevented D.C. residents from having any operable firearm at all in their homes. Now that the court has finally spoken on the issue, there's going to be intense interest in the inevitable follow-up litigation. Test cases have already been filed, and defense attorneys are going to be raising Second Amendment defenses in a large variety of cases. This will generate a lot of debate in which Heller will be taken as the law. Naturally, courts and litigants will become preoccupied with interpreting Justice Scalia's majority opinion, and that's both inevitable and entirely appropriate. Before the world moves on to these pressing questions, though, I thought it might be fitting to pause for just a moment at this Federalist Society event to ask what the decision tells us about originalism as a judicial philosophy. The threshold issue in the case, in the Heller case, had to do with the meaning of this somewhat puzzling constitutional text. As you know, the Second Amendment reads as follows: a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. If you focus on the reference to a well-regulated militia, you might think that this merely protects a right to have weapons when you're serving in a governmentally regulated military organization. If you focus on the operative clause, you'll probably think that the right extends to people in their private capacity and thus guarantees a right to have weapons for self-defense. One piece of good news about Heller from the point of view of originalism is that all 9 justices agreed that the choice between these two readings can and should be made on the basis of the original public meaning of the text. In other words, everyone agreed that the court should be bound by what these words meant to those who adopted the Bill of Rights in the 18th century. Another piece of very, very good news is that a majority of the court joined in Justice Scalia's overwhelmingly powerful and detailed demonstration that one of these readings is correct and the other one is wrong. The corresponding bad news is that only 5 justices joined his opinion. A near majority of this court signed on to what I think is the transparently untenable faux originalism of Justice Stevens' dissent. I don't think that this proves by any means that it's all about policy preferences up at the Supreme Court, but it does make you wonder whether reasoned arguments have anywhere near the influence that they ought to have in what's supposed to be a court of law. Once the Heller Court settled this threshold question about the general nature of the right to arms, it had to decide the specific issues raised by the D.C. statutes. One of the questions was easy. The requirement that all firearms be disabled at all times is a complete deprivation of the right protected by the Second Amendment, and it had to be struck down. The ban on handguns presented a more difficult question, and Scalia's opinion is somewhat confusing about the reasons for invalidating this provision of the law. At several points in his opinion, Justice Scalia seems to insist that questions about the scope of Second Amendment rights will be decided on the basis of an historical inquiry. This appears to mean that arguments about the costs and benefits of modern gun control regulations should be almost entirely irrelevant to the constitutional analysis. The four dissenters, in an opinion by Justice Breyer, argued that any private right to arms must be subjected to an interest-balancing inquiry, which would be informed by an empirical cost-benefit analysis of the challenged regulation. Scalia dismisses this entire inquiry on the ground that the relevant interest balancing has already been done by the Constitution. This sounds like a thoroughly originalist approach. When he addresses the handgun ban specifically, however, Scalia provides virtually no historical analysis. Instead, he says, using the present tense, the handgun ban amounts to a prohibition of an entire class of arms that is overwhelmingly chosen by American society for the lawful purpose of self-defense. He then goes on to explain why people might prefer handguns over long guns and concludes, again using the present tense, by saying that whatever the reason, handguns are the most popular weapon chosen by Americans for self-defense in the home, and a complete prohibition of their use is invalid. If this is meant to be an historical or originalist argument, it would seem, at least to me, to need a more detailed explanation than we get in the opinion. Even more troubling, though, is a series of dicta in which the majority approves several kinds of gun control that were not at issue in the case. Little analysis is provided, and Justice Scalia says that the historical justifications will be provided if and when an actual case is presented. This may be overstating it a little bit, but it sounds maybe a little bit like verdict first and trial later, if at all. Moreover, some of the Second Amendment exceptions listed by the majority in its dicta are quite problematic. Consider just three examples. First, the court says that convicted felons may be disarmed. Is it truly consistent with the original meaning of the Second Amendment to leave an American citizen defenseless for the rest of her life just because she was convicted of a nonviolent felony like tax evasion or insider trading? Next, the court approves gun-free zones in what Scalia calls sensitive places like schools and government buildings. On what basis will courts decide whether particular places are sufficiently sensitive to justify disarming citizens who go there? Is a university campus more sensitive than a shopping mall across the street? Did the whole city of New Orleans become a sensitive place after Hurricane Katrina, thus allowing the government to confiscate weapons from law-abiding citizens whom the government could not protect from the roving bands of criminals and looters? Finally, the court approves bans on what Scalia calls dangerous and unusual weapons, including short-barreled shotguns. Did short-barreled shotguns, which are very useful for self-defense and in some cases superior to handguns, become dangerous and unusual just because Congress decided to restrict them in 1934? This example is troublesome for an additional reason. It's based largely on an unnecessarily broad reading of the court's 1939 Miller decision and also on what I think is a misinterpretation of the relevant language in Miller. Now, I began on a cheery note, and I'd like to end on one as well. The next really big question is whether the Second Amendment applies to state and local governments through the 14th Amendment, and Heller, of course, left that question open. If the Supreme Court follows its tradition of selective incorporation, it will decide that question under the doctrine of substantive due process. Substantive due process is perhaps the most anti-originalist and even anti-constitutional doctrine in all of constitutional law. If Second Amendment incorporation were to be considered on originalist grounds, the court should look instead to the Privileges or Immunities Clause. The outcome might be the same, but it would be intellectually refreshing if the court were to conduct a genuine originalist inquiry when it faces the incorporation question. After Heller, maybe that's not too much to hope for. Thank you.
All right, Ted is going to pick it up from there. I think you're going to talk a little bit about Heller and focus on Medellin and, of course, Kennedy versus Louisiana, a case that Ted had an interest in, the on part of the state of Texas, the big death penalty case for child rapists. So, Ted.
Thank you, Jan, and I wanted to thank the Federal Society for inviting me to be here and for everyone for coming out to join this discussion. It was a remarkable term at the court. You know, on Heller, which Nelson was just discussing, one interesting point on the final question of incorporation, which is that Texas authored a brief for 31 states in Heller supporting the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. And notably in that brief, the 31 amici states all explicitly endorsed incorporation. So as we move forward and see further litigation on the question of whether the Second Amendment applies against the states, a majority of the states right now are on record agreeing with that proposition. And so I think it'll be interesting to see how the litigation proceeds. This term as a whole was characterized by a handful of very high-profile 5-4 decisions, as has been the case in for several terms going back, and then by an even larger number of very high-profile, difficult, important decisions that were decided not by 5-4 but by large majorities. And that stands in stark contrast to the preceding term, where virtually every major case broke down to a 5-4 majority. If you look at, for example, Medellin versus Texas, Medellin's a case I argued back in October. It was a remarkable case that raised federalism and separation of powers issues that really cut across every axis of the structural limitations on government. It's a case that arose out of a lawsuit that was filed by the nation of Mexico against the United States in the World Court, in the International Court of Justice, and it concerned the interpretation of a treaty, the Vienna Convention on Consular Affairs. And several years ago, the World Court issued an extraordinary order. It ordered the United States to review and to reopen the convictions and death sentences of 51 Mexican nationals on death row throughout the United States. It was the first time in the history of our nation that any foreign tribunal has ever attempted to assert the authority to directly bind the U.S. justice system, and much less to do so reopening final criminal convictions. The case took an even stranger wrinkle on February 28, 2005, when the President of the United States, George W. Bush, signed a 2-paragraph order that purported to order the state courts to obey the World Court, much like the decision of the World Court. That presidential order was unprecedented, which DOJ, to their credit, candidly admitted in their briefing that there was no precedent in our history for an order from the president to the state courts to do anything, much less to set aside validly enacted state law in the name of international comity. Now, this was a case that Texas found itself arrayed against a remarkable group of parties on the other side and litigants on the other side. I think the count is we had something like 81 nations file amicus briefs against us in the U.S. Supreme Court, which made me very, very unpopular with my in-laws as they traveled to Europe. And in addition to that, Texas found ourselves in the unusual position of being directly opposing the United States and the U.S. Solicitor General, who defended the president's order, because the Texas State Court of Criminal Appeals unanimously struck down the president's order as unconstitutional. So Medellin was argued in October. A couple of months ago, the U.S. Supreme Court decided it, and remarkably, it was a 6-3 decision. 6-3, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed across the board with the state of Texas. It concluded the World Court has no authority whatsoever to bind the U.S. justice system. that under our Constitution, it is the U.S. instruments of law. It is the U.S. Constitution. It is the U.S. Congress, the President, and the Supreme Court that define American law. And the court also concluded that the President lacked the authority to direct the state courts to obey the World Court decision. It was a remarkable opinion. Chief Justice Roberts wrote the majority opinion, and it is a tour de force of separation of powers, of federalism, and of international law. It has been widely commented in recent terms about the court's increasing reliance on international law, and I think that will remain a factor in years to come. That notwithstanding, this decision, in my judgment, was a significant victory for U.S. sovereignty. That what the court concluded is that ultimately the law in the United States of America will be determined by the governmental entities that are empowered by we the people to enact the law that governs Americans. A couple of other cases I will very briefly mention that were also decided by overwhelming majorities. Bays versus Reese, which is a constitutional challenge to the method of execution of lethal injection. That was a very high-profile case. A number of death penalty advocates hoped it would usher in a permanent or at least prolonged halt in executions. By a vote of 7-2, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected the claim. And it was an opinion. The Chief Justice authored a plurality that categorically rejected the claim and that made clear that similar such claims are unlikely to succeed in subsequent litigation. Another case like that is the Crawford case, which concerned the Indiana photo ID case. This is another case that generated a great deal of attention, and I think most analysts predicted this is going to be a 6-3 decision, a 5-4 decision. It wasn't. It was 6-3. And by a vote of 6-3, the court rejected the claim, really focusing on, as it had in Bays, what evidence the plaintiffs had presented. And the court concluded that they hadn't proven their case, that there was not evidence of actual plaintiffs who had been actually harmed, that the challenge framed as a facial challenge was essentially a hypothetical challenge. And the court said, we're going to adjudicate cases based on the actual facts on the case and controversy before us, and so they haven't proven their case. The final case I will mention briefly is Kennedy versus Louisiana. Kennedy did not follow the pattern of an overwhelming majority. It was a 5-4 decision handed down this past week. It concerned the constitutionality of laws providing capital punishment for the most egregious child rapists. It's another case I argued on behalf of 9 states supporting the state of Louisiana, and we ended up getting 4/5 of the way to where we needed to go. Justice Kennedy wrote an opinion for the court in which he explained that providing capital punishment for child rapists is inconsistent with the court's conception of evolving standards of decency, and the 7 state legislatures that had concluded to the contrary were not within the court's view of what evolving standards of decency entail. The court further concluded as a matter of law that child rapists are categorically less culpable than murderers. And finally, the court derived what it described as a national consensus against the application of capital punishment concerning child rape, which I think there has been substantial criticism of that, what has been characterized as the national consensus. And in many ways, the most compelling refutation of what the court described as a consensus is within hours of the decision coming down, both major presidential candidates, John McCain and Barack Obama, denounced the decision as wrong. So apparently a 5-justice majority of the court has explained that there is a national consensus, notwithstanding the fact that both Senator McCain and Senator Obama loudly believe it is incorrect as a matter of policy and a matter of law. And so those were several of the cases in which the states found themselves litigating this term.
Charles is going to talk about some of the business cases that the court took a look at this term and whether this is or is not a business-oriented court. And obviously this is an interesting area to look at because we talked, as Ted did, and certainly as Nelson, about some of these very closely divided 5-4 cases. But in this area, you don't see those 5-4 splits along ideological lines. So why is that?
Well, that's an interesting question. We do see those splits to some extent. There were two cases this year, two important business cases, the Stone Ridge case and the Exxon case, in which not 5-4. Stone Ridge was a 5-3. It could have been a 5-4 if Justice Breyer hadn't been recused. And it was a 6-3 in the Exxon case. I'll touch on some of these points. And thank you, Jay, and thank you, Lee, and the Federalist Society for inviting me here. I'll talk briefly about the business cases. That's a topic that's difficult to get your arms around because it's not always obvious what qualifies as a business case. The court decides lots of cases that have a significant impact on business. But however the term is defined, it's clear that business has generally been doing quite well in the court, not just this year, but in prior years. And this has gotten a fair amount of attention. There was a cover piece in the New York Times magazine earlier this year that labeled it the business court, and it was illustrated by a drawing of the justices playing golf in their robes. 2 years ago, the court gave so many wins to business that it was widely described as the Chamber of Commerce Court. And it's quite clear that, unlike some of the other areas that Jan mentioned in which the law has flipped with the change in the composition, that has not been the case in the business context. Chief Justice Rehnquist and Chief Justice Roberts are both quite sympathetic to business. Justice O'Connor, however unpredictable she may have been in other areas of the law, was a quite predictable vote for business interests, and she probably was, during her time in the court, the favored justice of corporate America. So it was not change in composition of the court that's moved it in the direction of business. So what happened to the court this year in business? I'd like to say that there was something really startling and interesting that I could report, but I can't. There were a lot of very important business cases, and as it had the year before, business won almost all, not quite all, but almost all of the important cases across a very wide range of unrelated subject areas: securities law, key TAM actions, punitive damages, federal preemption. It's sort of a litany of success in important areas for business. And most of these cases were actually not that close. The Stone Ridge case was an exception, but most of them were decided by 8-1, 7-2 votes. And I'll just sort of tick off some of the most significant ones. The one that was probably most anticipated by the business community was Stone Ridge Investment Partners versus Scientific Atlanta, which is a case in which the court rejected the idea of scheme liability under federal securities fraud statutes, which seems like a technical question, but it actually was one of enormous practical importance for all businesses whose shares are traded on the national exchange and all businesses that do business with publicly traded companies. Under scheme liability, defendants could be liable for securities fraud not only if they made a false statement that somehow made its way to the markets, but also if they could be said to have been involved in a scheme to defraud. So it could have swept in as defendants entities like the investment banks that worked with Enron, accountants and lawyers that worked with businesses, suppliers of businesses. So it was a case that attracted enormous attention in the business community. There were an extraordinary 16 amicus briefs filed on both sides of the case, something which is really unprecedented in a business case. I mean, that's the kind of public involvement that you see otherwise only in the most high-profile, hot-button social issue cases. So it was a case that defendants, potential defendants in the corporate world, cared about enormously. And the defense side won. It was a 5-3 vote written by Justice Kennedy, Justice Breyer not participating. And I think something that's interesting about the way in which the court analyzed the case, and maybe an example of a phenomenon that you see often in business cases, is that the court over time picks up on an issue or a problem and gets educated about it in a series of cases, eventually internalizes what it learns in these series of cases, and then finally expresses what it's learned and internalized in its opinions. In the Stone Ridge context, I think the concept that the court was interested in was the idea of abusive strike suit litigation that's designed to not really accomplish much except to extract settlement from a deep pocket defendant. That's a concept that Judge Henry Friendly, late Judge Henry Friendly of the Second Circuit, for whom John Roberts clerked, talked about a lot in the 70s. Then Justice Rehnquist, when he joined the court early on, talked a lot about that and worked the concept into his opinions. It became more and more prominent in a number of the court's business decisions, not just in securities cases like Stone Ridge, but antitrust cases, other really big ticket, big money cases. And the court has given it increasing emphasis, and that clearly had a significant impact in the analysis that the court used in Stone Ridge. The same kind of phenomenon might be visible in the Exxon case, the Exxon punitive damages case, which grew out of the tanker catastrophe, Exxon Valdez, in which the court set aside the $2.5 billion punitive damages award and reduced it, slashed it to $500 million. Punitive damages is also an area in which the court has been entertaining cases for 25 or so years. It's probably decided six or so cases on the merits during that time. It's probably entertained hundreds of cert petitions that presented what the petitioners described as, you know, excessive, irrational, arbitrary, shocking punitive damages awards. And the court clearly over that time has gotten concerned about this problem. Up until Exxon, there was a limited amount the court has been able to do about it. All of the cases that have reached the court in the punitive damages context have come from state courts. They've involved state common law. For the Supreme Court to get involved at all, it's had to use the very blunt instrument of substantive due process, which, as Nelson described, is a controversial concept in the first place. Some of the justices whom you would expect to be most hostile to punitive damages, like Justices Scalia and Thomas, don't believe in substantive due process really at all. And so, you know, that limited the amount the court could say about it. So it's been reduced in prior cases to simply saying that particular awards going to shock the conscience. They were so big, so irrational, so arbitrary that they just they couldn't survive even the roughest constitutional scrutiny. The Exxon case was an interesting contrast because that's the first punitive damages case the court has entertained that involved federal law, involved federal common maritime law. So it gave the justices their first chance to really explain what they think about punitive damages as a doctrine and how they think when they're free to design the rules, punitive damages should be awarded. And the result, I think, as a result of this education they've gotten over the years, what was quite a scholarly opinion written by Justice Souter, who joined the majority in slashing the award, in which it's sort of fuzzy around the edges, but essentially says that at least when there's a large, very large compensatory award, punitive damages should be more or less capped at one-to-one ratio of punitive to compensatory damages. And although it ostensibly involved only maritime law, which is a pretty narrow and esoteric and abstruse part of the law, because this is the court's first chance to really express itself on punitive damages analysis more generally, it's probably going to be quite an influential opinion, which is going to work its way not only into the constitutional analysis that the court subsequently uses in later cases, but the kind of approach that state courts take when they design their own punitive damages laws. I mentioned one other area quite important to business that was very active this year, and that's federal preemption, which of course is the doctrine that says that state laws that are inconsistent with federal laws can't survive. That probably is the single area of the law that is most important to, you know, corporate America. Most big businesses that do national business would much rather have a single federal rule, almost no matter what it says, than have to deal with 50 possibly inconsistent varying state rules. And so focus on federal preemption has been really an essential emphasis of businesses in litigation and in Supreme Court litigation in particular. The court decided four preemption cases this year on the merits. It divided equally on a fifth, but it decided four of them. The business side won all four, none of them by close votes, across sort of all areas of the law involving medical device regulation, labor law, arbitration, tobacco regulation, and that really has been a tremendous success for the business community in the court because, as I say, it's something that really, in terms of its practical impact, is perhaps the most important issue the court faces. If you look at the preemption doctrine over the years, it's really a fascinating picture of the evolution of the way the court has approached it. 25 years ago, it was the liberals on the court, you know, Justices Brennan and Marshall and Blackmun, Justice White, not so liberal, but who were the greatest believers in a powerful federal preemption doctrine. And it was the conservatives on the court who were most resistant to federal preemption. And clearly on the liberal side, that was an outgrowth of the 60s and the civil rights movement. And the idea that when you talked about states' rights, you were talking about Jim Crow and segregation. And, you know, clearly Justice Brennan and Justice Marshall sort of had that picture of federal authority in mind. And on the conservative side at that time, It clearly, it was sort of the traditional conservative skepticism of expansive federal authority. So if you look at the votes in those years, and that's sort of what you got. You would get sometimes votes of five or six of the justices on the left saying yes, preempt, and three or four justices on the right saying don't. That has flipped almost completely, and maybe as a reaction to the Reagan and Gingrich revolutions, you now see that it is the conservatives on the court who, generally speaking, are most vigorously prepared to assert federal preemptive authority, and it's the liberals who tend to resist that. It may be that one reason that the business community has done so well in these cases is that the conservative side of the court has flipped more completely and enthusiastically on preemption than the liberal side has. Because I think that some of the people on the left of the court continue to have sort of the old 60s picture of federal authority, some of the same old skepticism of the states, and they probably also have in the back of their minds, you know, when Speaker Pelosi is writing laws and President Obama is signing them, we want to have expansive federal preemption authority. We can talk in more detail in questions about exactly how this has come to be. I'll mention one other, very briefly, just one sort of parenthetical thing about business cases, which I think is unique to the business decisions of the court, and that's the court's recusal problem. A number of the justices have substantial stock holdings, including particularly Justice Breyer, but also Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito. As a result, really only in business cases in which there's a business party, justices have been forced to recuse themselves in several important cases, every year the past couple of years. There were two cases this year in which that happened, and one of them was yet another preemption case involving medical regulation in which the Chief Justice was recused. Another was the Exxon case in which Justice Alito did not participate, and the court split 4-4 on a very important question of whether punitive damages can support vicarious liability. There was also a real embarrassment for the court. There was what would have been a very important case under the Alien Tort Statute, which is a very significant statute that has become increasingly controversial and is used very widely and allows people to sue in the United States for violations of international law that take place elsewhere. There was a suit that was brought in New York against more than 50 large corporations that did business in South Africa during the apartheid era under the Alien Tort Statute. The companies filed a cert petition supported by the United States, which filed an uninvited brief in support of the cert petition, quite unusual. And the court couldn't take action on the case because five justices were recused. The Chief, Breyer, Alito, and Justice Kennedy, who was probably recused because Credit Suisse was involved and his son works at Credit Suisse. And six justices are a quorum. Only five could participate, so the court had to affirm the decision of the Second Circuit in that case, which was quite an embarrassment for the court. I hope so much so that the justices will kind of reconsider their holdings and try to divest themselves to prevent this from happening in the future. Okay.
Now we're going to hear from Orr, and we're going to go back to some more closely divided issues. He's going to talk about Kennedy, which Ted gave you a brief summary of, the child rape case, and Boumediene, which was, of course, the hugely significant case involving the ability of detainees down at Guantanamo to get into federal courts. Orr is, of course, shares his insight, as I said, on Volokh, which I'm sure you guys know, and if you don't, you should look at it. And he also, as I said, clerked for Justice Kennedy, who wrote both of these opinions. So thank you. Explain all this to us, Orrin, make some sense of it.
Thanks, Jan. Pleasure to be here. There's a tendency, a natural tendency, I think, for those of us who follow the Supreme Court, to view Supreme Court decisions a bit like sporting events. There are two teams. We can call them the libs and the cons. And they play the game of Justice Kennedy, come our way. And so when we look at Supreme Court decisions, we think we know what happened when Justice Kennedy picks one side or the other, and it's 5-4 with sort of an ideological split. a 5-4. And when it's some other sort of a split, or if a controversial case is 6-3 or 7-2, we have to try to understand what happened here. And I think that's a very common way of approaching Supreme Court decisions and understanding what happens in the decisions. And we could certainly interpret a number of the big cases this term in that way. I think, though, it's important when we do so to look at sort of a broader level, the role of the Supreme Court in American society today. What's important about this term is, I think, how many things we're not talking about. The Supreme Court took very few cases this term. The cases it decided were generally pretty narrow. What's interesting about the court now is that it does not seem to have a significant agenda one way or the other. Certainly individual justices have individual priorities, types of cases they're interested in, law that they would either like very much to retain or perhaps to change. But I think the big picture of the current Supreme Court is really one of the Supreme Court having a narrow role. The cases it decides tend to be pretty narrow, and again, it decides fairly few cases. So that's my big picture overview. And as it turns out, we were having a conference call to discuss this panel. I drew a discussion of the two cases that point most against that narrative, Boumediene and Kennedy versus Louisiana. So let me talk a bit about these cases and come back to my theme and explain why I think my theme is still valid despite these two controversial and hotly contested 5-4 cases, with Justice Kennedy writing the majority opinions in both cases. So in the Boumediene case is the Guantanamo Bay case, and this is really the last back and forth in a ping pong match we've seen between Congress and the Supreme Court for the last 4 or 5 years. And the question is whether the detainees at Guantanamo Bay that have been designated by the executive branch as enemy combatants have a right to come into federal court and get a hearing, and exactly what kind of hearing they can get on whether they are being properly detained. This issue went up to the Supreme Court in 2004 in a case called Rasul versus Bush. The Supreme Court, by a 6-3 vote, concluded that, yes, the detainees do have a right, but a statutory right to a resolution of their claims in federal court. Congress then took the ball back into their court and said, well, then if you say it's a statutory right, we're repealing the statute. Went back to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, oh, yeah, well, we think you're not being clear enough that you're repealing it by statute, so we're going to say you haven't repealed it by statute. Went back to Congress. Congress said, okay, well, now we're going to be really extra clear that we're repealing statutory jurisdiction. Then it goes back to the Supreme Court, where in Boumediene versus Bush just a few weeks ago, the Supreme Court says, well, you can't do that. As a constitutional matter, there's constitutional right to habeas jurisdiction for the detainees in Guantanamo Bay. The reasoning of the case largely tracks what you could see in the 2004 opinion four years ago in Rasul versus Bush, the idea that Guantanamo Bay is really part of the United States for habeas purposes. Guantanamo Bay is sort of an odd entity. It's technically in Cuba, but the U.S. has a lease. It's not kind of a typical sort of a lease. It's really almost like the U.S. owns it, but it doesn't quite. And it was unclear, I think, under prior precedents whether this would count as part of the United States or outside the United States for habeas purposes. The Bush administration had clearly relied on the argument that it would not be part of the United States, that there would be no habeas writ, the detainees could not come into federal court and get review of their claims. The Supreme Court in 2004 in Rasul strongly indicated to the contrary. In fact, Justice Kennedy, who becomes the swing, the most important fifth vote in the Boumediene case recently, in 2004 wrote a concurrence largely laying out his views, which the Supreme Court adopts in Kennedy's own opinion in 2008. The notion being that there's the precise scope of the habeas writ, of this ability of detainees to come into federal court, is a functional question. It depends on the nature of the claim, the role of the executive, whether it's a criminal case, whether the person's being detained by the executive, where the detention's occurring, what the case of military need is, what the exigencies might be, and that in this case, the detainees do have a right to habeas corpus. And then the court says, okay, well, Congress clearly wants to take away this right of habeas corpus. What does the Constitution require as a substitute to the traditional statutory writ. And the court goes through a couple factors that need to be there as a matter of constitutional law, a supplementing of the record in particular, and the possibility of being able to order release in district court. And then says, well, this is a complicated framework. We're not saying exactly how this is going to play out. Here, district court for the District of Columbia, now the ball's in your court rather than going back to Congress. Now we're still in the courts. This is a case which has been criticized as being an unwarranted exercise of judicial power. I think it was a really difficult case, given the court's precedence, but one that was clearly foreshadowed by Rasul versus Bush. This is a very easily predicted result. In fact, many people had predicted it, that the court was going to say there was a constitutional right here to habeas corpus, and it was just a question of when that was going to happen. So really, I think the end effect of the Boumediene case, and this is returning back to my theme, is that we're back where we were in 2004, except Congress now can't act past the Detainee Treatment Act and try to take away jurisdiction. So in a lot of ways, we're back where we thought we were in 2004 before Congress acted again, and now the detainees have a right to come into court. The unsettled question, the question we really don't know, and the most important one, is just what rights do they have? In the Boumediene case, the court did not talk about what the substantive rights they had are. This was all about, can you get into court? What kind of court hearing do you get? But exactly what kind of constitutional right the detainees have is now what the lower courts are going to have to settle. So it was a narrow decision in that case. It didn't resolve what rights detainees have. I don't have a lot of time, so I want to quickly go through Kennedy versus Louisiana, the child rape capital statute. This is another in a series of Eighth Amendment cases, Roper versus Simmons being the most recent one, where the court is applying the its recent jurisprudence on Eighth Amendment claims, and in particular sort of applying this evolving standards of decency test to really controversial decisions, hotly contested decisions among different states as to whether to allow the death penalty in certain contexts. The court holds, again, by 5-4 vote, with Justice Kennedy writing the majority opinion, as he did in Roper versus Simmons in 2005, that the Constitution does not allow for punishment for those individuals that have committed rape of a child that did not lead to death. And clearly the opinion has a lot of statements that express a certain skepticism of the death penalty, questioning of the death penalty. I don't think that language really suggests that the court is ready to abolish the death penalty. My general test for determining what the Supreme Court's going to do in death penalty cases involving the Eighth Amendment, if it affects fewer than 100 people, the court will strike it down. And if it affects more than 100 people, the court will uphold it. And that seems to have worked so far pretty well, describing what the court will do. If something only affects a narrow group, I think the court feels a little bit freer to act, whereas once we're talking about a larger group, for example, Bays versus Rees in the execution protocol case, the court was much more deferential in that case, much more recognizing that if the court interferes in a case involving execution protocols, that stops the death penalty generally. In the Kennedy versus Louisiana case, very few states enacted such laws. I think only two people were on death row for child rape, Kennedy being one of them. So despite the language in the case is very broad, the actual scope of the opinion, the impact of the opinion, is quite narrow, and it impacts a small number of people. Now, of course, it might have impacted a larger crowd depending on what would have happened if the court had not struck down this law. We don't know what would have happened in terms of various states enacting these sorts of statutes if the court had allowed it. And I think that's an absolutely valid criticism of the case, and one that I personally find pretty persuasive. But at the same time, it's important to recognize the scope of the decision is actually pretty narrow. It doesn't affect that many people. It largely applies the Roper versus Simmons framework, and I think it's pretty consistent with the Roper case from just a few years ago. And I think the common theme here with Boumediene and Kennedy versus Louisiana, yes, these are hotly contested, 5-4, very controversial, ideologically charged cases, but there are also pretty predictable results. I think if you look at Roper versus Simmons from a few terms ago, you can pretty much predict Kennedy versus Louisiana. If you look at Rasul versus Bush from 2004, you can pretty much predict Boumediene. So what we're seeing here is the court applying some of its earlier precedents, the individual justices, I think, being pretty consistent with what they've said in the past. So while we sort of have this, again, that's going back to the sporting event analogy, you know, it's like the next season, right? And there's the Yankees playing the Red Sox again, and we all get really excited again, and it's the same event we've seen before, and we replay it. At the same time, the court as a whole really is not stepping off in new directions in any particularly dramatic way. Relatively modest court, doing relatively modest, making incremental steps, sometimes in one direction, sometimes in the other direction. And I think that framework explains both Boumediene and Kennedy. Thanks.
All right, so that was certainly the story of this term, and thanks, Oren. But, you know, if we think back to two terms ago, it looked like this court was really stepping out in some very different directions. So after the second full year of the new Roberts Court, Rachel is going to talk about the last two terms and the differences in the lineup we're seeing in the role of Justice Kennedy. And like I said, she's the perfect person for us to hear from, having really kind of been responsible for helping get those two guys nominated and confirmed, and then, of course, clerking for Justice Kennedy. So thanks, Rachel.
Thanks, Jan. It's good to be here. I'm going to focus in particular on Justice Kennedy's role in the court this term. Just by way of background, you'll all remember that last term he completely dominated the court. He was in the majority almost every time, having dissented only twice in 72 cases. That was less than 3% of the cases, and it had been about 40 years since any justice had dissented so few times in one term. He also was the key vote in every 5-4 case last term. And you'll also recall that last year saw an unusually high number of 5-4 decisions, 24 out of 72, and Kennedy was in the majority in every single one. So this was really remarkable, and it got a huge amount of attention from the press and the academy and the public. So the question in my mind was whether last year was a bit of an aberration or whether it portended a trend. Last term you saw everyone talking about the Kennedy Court, even though Roberts had just been confirmed. And, you know, did Roberts sort of take back the reins of power this term or didn't he? The short answer is that the numbers this term aren't nearly as remarkable as they were last term. So where I come down is that Kennedy is still the man in the middle. He still is the key vote on the highest profile cases, like the ones that Oren was talking about. But his complete dominance of the court, I think, was a bit of an aberration. So let's look at the numbers. And I should say at the outset that I got some of these numbers from Tom's excellent website, scotusblog.com. If you want to see all the statistics sliced and diced lots of different ways, go on Tom's blog and look for the stat pack. It's really good stuff. So this term, the court decided 71 cases, if you include summary reversals and affirmances by an equally divided court. Kennedy dissented in 10 of them, or 14% of cases, as opposed to last term's 3% of the cases. That's the same rate at which he dissented in the 04 term, and it's slightly higher than the rate at which he dissented in the 05 term, which was 11%. Notably, he dissented more often this past term than Roberts did. Roberts dissented only 7 times, or 10% of the cases. And Kennedy's dissents came in lots of different subject matter areas, so it's hard to draw some overarching conclusion about whether Kennedy has a real, you know, issue in some area or whether he's out of step with his colleagues in some area. So just to look at the 10 cases where he dissented, 3 of them involved issues of constitutional law on the First Amendment, the Sixth Amendment's Confrontation Clause, and the Dormant Commerce Clause. 4 of them involved statutory construction questions. 1 interpreted a federal rule of criminal procedure. 1 involved the retroactivity of judicial decisions for habeas purposes. And 1 addressed standards of review in ERISA cases. So they are all over the map, really. And they were certainly not necessarily in all that significant of cases. So it's also hard to infer much from who Kennedy was with in those dissents. In his 10 dissents, he was with Breyer the most often, 5 out of 10 times. He was with Alito, Stevens, and Scalia 3 times each. Roberts, Ginsburg, and Souter twice each, and with Thomas only once. And that's basically consistent with his overall agreement rate with the other justices. So, again, if you look at all of his votes, not just the dissents, he agreed with Breyer the most often, 85% of the time. Roberts the next most often with 84%, Alito 82%, Stevens and Scalia each 77%, Souter 74%, Ginsburg 72%, and Thomas the least often, 62% of cases. So it's, you know, based on those numbers, it's sort of interesting to note that he agreed equally as often with Scalia as he did with Stevens, which would support his reputation as a swing justice. So then turning to the issue of 5-4 decisions, there were many fewer of those this year than last year, 11 compared to 24. And it's, you know, there's been a lot of speculation about why that is, and there are lots of theories out there. It could be that the justices were just fed up after last term and they couldn't take it anymore and they just wanted to get along. It could be that the Chief Justice really made an effort to narrow the scope of decisions to get more votes. He did say at the beginning of his tenure that he was focused on unanimity or at least consensus, and so maybe he was really making a concerted effort there. Some political scientists have speculated that the court moderates itself in election years, that it issues fewer 5-4 decisions in those years. I'm a little skeptical of that because at least historically maybe that was true, but the court is going to be an issue in this campaign regardless of what it does. And if the court was trying to keep itself out of the campaign, it did a very bad job because, as you've seen, and somebody here mentioned that, like Ted mentioned, that Obama and McCain both talked about Kennedy versus Louisiana. There's been discussion about Boumediene. They both talked about Heller, and they may have talked about other cases too. So clearly, they are at issue this fall. Another reason might be that there were just fewer really blockbuster cases this term than last term. Because, after all, Kennedy versus Louisiana and Heller and Boumediene were decided 5-4. On the other hand, if you look at the slightly lower profile but still pretty important cases, they were decided by wider margins. So Ted was talking about this, too. You've got Bays v. Rees, the lethal injection case, decided 7-2. You've got Williams, the child pornography pandering case, the First Amendment case, also decided 7-2. You've got Crawford, the Indiana voter ID case, decided 6-3, and Medellin decided 6-3. To look at Justice Kennedy's role in the 5-4 cases, again, he was less dominant this year than last year. Last year, he was in the majority in all 24. This term, he was in the majority in only 7 out of 11. Now, the four cases in which he dissented don't really give you much guidance about what's going on. They included an age discrimination case, a criminal procedure case involving sentencing, a case interpreting the federal money laundering statute, and a case interpreting the Federal Tort Claims Act. So they were all over the place. Now, the fact that he did not totally dominate does not mean that he is not still the swing justice in the highest profile cases. Now, to my mind, the four highest profile cases this term, at least if you just go by public attention outside the legal field, I would say those four cases are Heller, Boumediene, Stone Ridge, and Kennedy versus Louisiana. And that's my arbitrary sample, and others can disagree. But if you look at that sample, Kennedy's role really was remarkable. He was in the majority in all four of those cases. He wrote the majority opinion in three of them. It's worth noting that three of the four were 5-4 decisions, with Stone Ridge being a 5-3 decision. It's also interesting, in terms of his reputation as swing justice, that each of those cases was decided along so-called liberal-conservative block lines. In two of them, he was with the conservatives, and in two of them, he was with the libs. So, again, you know, in the highest profile cases, he does still occupy that role. So my bottom line is, although I think it's a bit much to call this the Kennedy court, as people have been doing, he still clearly exercises outsized influence in those highest profile cases. That is the reason why the outcome of this election might be so significant. He is not a reliably conservative vote, and I know Tom's going to talk about that issue in more detail, so I'll stop there.
All right, now, you guys, as you know, Tom follows the court as closely as anybody, and as Rachel pointed out, his SCOTUS blog is really this kind of must-read, and he monitors the cases out in the lower courts. He tries to predict which cases the court is going to take or is not going to take, and now he's going to tell us which justice is going to retire next.
Thank you so much. People have been unduly kind to me. It is a great pleasure to be here at the Federal Society. It's a fantastic organization that really invites people of diverse viewpoints to come and talk, and I also very much appreciate it because you feel obliged to applaud, and that will make me feel much better. Everybody here and on watching on television will regard that not as being polite but as an endorsement, so be careful. You could look at my my topic, which is, you know, relating the court to the presidential election to be essentially on the heels of Rachel. You know, how mad is the country at Justice Kennedy, and what are your prospects of making him irrelevant? And so, you know, what is the Supreme Court going to mean in the 08 presidential election, and then what will the presidential election mean for the court itself, given that on many issues, as Rachel describes, it's quite closely divided. Going into this term, there was the prospect for progressive and liberal organizations that they were going to try and make the Supreme Court a rallying cry on the heels of decisions relating to race and abortion, campaign finance. They kind of thought that they had the upper hand. And I had written at the beginning of this term that I thought that that was very dangerous because, you know, if you looked at the cases of this term and you looked at the politics of it and what side more liberal organizations were on, they were on the side of defending the terrorist, crack-dealing child pornographer, child rapist, which I know that everyone here thinks is entirely accurate. But nonetheless, given that at the time the economy was in better shape, it looked like there might be a little oxygen in the election for the Supreme Court as an issue because it was really the war, and what else would be really, really important. And so you come now to the 2008 election after this term, and you wonder, okay, will people care? And I know that people in this room care, and that's why you're here. There are, however, 100 million other people out there who are eligible voters, and they don't care. That's just the truth of the matter. We are going into this election cycle in which people are very worried about the price of gas, are worried about the price of the value of their homes. They are worried about the war and the war on terror, and they really don't pay much attention to the Supreme Court. And so this election, I think, is very much going to be like every other presidential election in which people think this could be the one where people really will focus, given how important the Supreme Court is, given that many important decisions hang by a single vote, where the public, general public will really get it. And I think the answer is no, that's not going to happen, and even if it should happen. Now, the reasons, I think, revolve around the fact that there's, as I've said, very little oxygen out there for this to be an issue, but also that the things that would create a rallying cry among undecided voters, as opposed to the base of either party, they just really didn't materialize. So, for example, if Heller had come out the other way, I think we could be having a very different conversation now because the country is broadly supportive of Second Amendment rights. I will tell you, and is extremely interested, SCOTUS blog, which people have been so kind to mention a few times, I put up a poll on the last day of the term, and SCOTUS blog is kind of a lawyer's place, right? And I asked, you know, who of the people who were waiting on the site for the decisions on the last day, and so that could be a broad cross-section of lawyers and the public, who among you is here for Heller and who among you is here for other reasons? And 96% of the respondents said that they were there to hear about Heller. 62% reported that they owned two or more firearms. One person sent in the comment said that he believed that he had approximately 15 firearms. He wasn't exactly sure. We said only good things about the gun decisions afterwards. I don't want to piss any of these people off. But, you know, there's a community that is not really angry at the Supreme Court and anxious to change it. There are people who have concerns with the Heller decision, but it is such a dramatic movement forward for that right, elevation from the junior varsity to the varsity, that, you know, we're going to take it seriously, that I don't think it's going to motivate a lot of people. On the other side, the most recent abortion decision we've had involves so-called partial birth abortion, which is not something that the public has a problem with regulating. And so outside the core committed pro-choice community, those folks aren't going to get really into this election on the basis of the Supreme Court. The Boumediene, or Dean, or however we pronounce that guy's name, Boumediene, John McCain really did briefly make an issue of it, but I think mostly for the conservative base. And Barack Obama has shown mostly a commitment to trying to diffuse the question and not defend particularly liberal positions. When it came to Heller, didn't sort of get up in arms and say this decision is wrong. Kennedy versus Louisiana has been described calling out the decision as wrong. It's trying to diffuse the Supreme Court as an issue more than elevate it as an issue. Another reason I don't think it's going to be a big deal is that there, of course, is no retirement this year. And there certainly won't be a retirement for any reason other than health right before the election. So it's not a focusing event that would cause people to think, oh, gosh, you know, I really ought to be worrying about the Supreme Court. Nonetheless, the Supreme Court has its place in the political process. It is significant in the sense that the base of both parties does really get the importance of the Supreme Court. I think conservatives get it much, much more than do liberals. They really realize the permanent significance of an appointment, how John Roberts and Justice Alito are going to be there for 30 years and have a profound effect on the jurisprudence of the Supreme Court and on American life, whereas the left just doesn't really understand how significant that is. And there is very much the prospect of retirement. Justice Stevens is 88 years old. He's making no plans to go anywhere, and each one of us would do well to be in that kind of health at the age of 88. But the idea that he would make it five more years through a second election cycle to 93 and a half seems just statistically unlikely. Certainly he's not planning on going anywhere. But also, it should be said that I don't think anybody is planning on going anywhere. Certainly nobody on the right of the Supreme Court is. The average age of a conservative appointment to the Supreme Court, thanks to Rachel, is 14. I mean, as soon as these guys clear high school, they are going to really hit their stride on the court. There's a tremendous amount of youth and vigor, intellectual vigor, on the Supreme Court from the right. On the left, Justice Ginsburg has tried to put out word that she believes that the Stevens model of staying really through into your 80s is the right one, and she certainly has no plans to retire. I don't think that Justice Souter it's been said that he may not be in love with Washington or the job, but I always think, you know, you're a Supreme Court justice, you're getting ready to write the letter that says, you know, I resign from the Supreme Court, and you just start to realize, God, this is like the world's greatest job. If we decide five cases a year, what am I going to do tomorrow? And so I think it's actually quite likely that either Barack Obama or John McCain will get to appoint a single justice. The only prospect for retirement is Justice Stevens. I think it'll happen in the summer of 2011. And it will be the question of whether the court can, for conservatives, can remove Justice Kennedy as a limiting agent for cases like Boumediene, for cases like Kennedy versus Louisiana, and for the left, for President Obama, whether there can be just a holding action in which a more youthful person will come in. But nonetheless, the court will become more conservative as a consequence, because Justice Stevens has juice in that building. He is a very sophisticated operator in terms of how to get in cases, how to deal with the majority, when to join the majority. He just knows the institution and is widely respected there, and anybody who comes in can't replace that voice for the left on the Supreme Court. So inevitably, the Supreme Court, I think, is going to get a little bit more conservative. The question is just how much.
All right, so I think what we're going to do is everyone's going to take one minute to respond, or two maybe, and then we're going to open it up to you guys for questions. So panelists, if there's something that you heard one of your fellow panelists say that struck you as, you know, particularly insane, go at it. Nelson, you want to go first?
Okay.
Go down the line?
Again? I certainly didn't hear anything insane. I did hear a lot of interesting things.
Should we hear the interesting things?
Yes.
Okay.
I thought one of the most interesting things I heard was kind of not fleshed out, as you can't on a panel like this, but Charles Rothfeld's thought that in the business area, the court gets educated through a series of cases. And I would like to hear more about what that process of education might be. Is it the court as a whole getting educated? Is it particularly, is certain justices who are certainly interested in things educating other justices? Or is it perhaps not so much a process of educating the court as incremental moves towards a goal through a series of cases? And in connection with that, I wonder how this ties in, if at all, but I think it might possibly tie in with Charles' comment about the preemption cases. It seems to me possible that what the court has, the change in the court's preemption jurisprudence could be the result of a kind of process of education where some decades ago they were operating on a very simple-minded, ideological understanding of preemption and federalism, and that they now have a much more sophisticated effect of the nature of competitive federalism and cooperative federalism and rent seeking in the states and so on that might in some way explain that shift. So this wasn't a criticism of Charles, but simply I wanted to point out how interesting his suggestion was to me.
And of course, we have a major preemption case that'll be argued in the fall, so they'll have another chance to go at it. Ted.
Like Nelson, I agreed with the vast majority of the comments that folks made. I want to amplify a point Rachel made about the resurgence of the Roberts Court. When Chief Justice Roberts was confirmed to the court, he said quite widely that he wanted to try to move away from bitter, divisive 5-4 decisions and seek greater unanimity. And at the end of last term, many commentators and pundits kind of happily pronounced the death of that vision, and as we had 24 quite acrimonious 5-4s, and I think there were a few kind of knowing snickers at well, that was always a little naive of the Chief Justice to think he could achieve unanimity with these nine individuals. And my view of last term, a year ago, was that much of the analysis on last term was misguided. I mean, the popular narrative was last term was this dramatic turn to the right, and that we would be 5-4 from here to eternity. I think the dramatic turn to the right last term was overstated. I think what really drove the 2006 term was the particular collection of issues that ended up before the court all happened to be, and I think this was almost purely serendipity, they all happened to be issues on which the court had previously resolved them the other way in narrow 5-4 decisions, typically authored by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, and every single one of the hot-button issues before the court last year were issues on which Justice Kennedy had dissented, and typically had dissented in passionate dissent. So whether you're talking about the campaign finance issues or whether you're talking about race in schools or whether you're talking about partial birth abortion, it was a little bit of a perfect storm. The cases that hit the court were all the cases on high-profile issues where Kennedy had been in quite strenuous dissent, and what we saw last term is in every single one of them, Justice Kennedy's views had not changed, and the only difference was instead of commanding 4 votes, they commanded 5. None of that suggested, I think, this dramatic turn to the right, because there are a whole host of other areas where Justice Kennedy's views, I think, cannot be fairly characterized as conservative from any perspective. So whether you look at, you know, I agree with Orrin that in both Boumediene and Kennedy, the Kennedy case, that the results were eminently predictable based upon Justice Kennedy's prior opinions and his past jurisprudence. But this term, I think, setting that aside, saw a resurgence of what the Chief Justice had stated his intent was, and I think the way the court achieved that was through a real focus on judicial minimalism, on avoiding broad challenges, on demanding that cases be proven up on their facts, on avoiding facial challenges and looking instead to the actual facts in an as-applied challenge. And I think that that may augur interesting trends as we go forward.
Well, I also didn't hear anything crazy, and I would never disagree with Tom. This is a very dangerous thing to do. I'll make two mini points instead of one big point. And Ted anticipated much of what I was going to say. I think in terms of trying to explain what went on in the court and why it's kind of seemingly flipped from 2 years ago to this year, I hesitate to say anything about Justice Kennedy surrounded by all these Kennedy clerks, which would be a dangerous place to be. But it was, in fact, you look at the makeup of the decisions 2 years ago, these were cases in which presenting issues in which Justice Kennedy has traditionally been to the right of the court, cases like abortion, cases like race. This year we have issues in which Justice Kennedy traditionally has not been to the left of the court, the capital punishment cases, executive power cases. And as time goes on, there will be other cases like that, cases involving religion, cases involving free speech, in which First Amendment cases generally, in which Justice Kennedy is not sort of anchored firmly on the right of the court. So I think, and Tom may have anticipated some of this in writing that he did last year, that the expectation that the court had really kind of switched dramatically ignored the unusual nature of the court's docket last year. A second thing, which also relates to a point that Ted made, of course, none of us actually really have any idea what's going on in the court. But Justice Scalia made what I thought was a very revealing comment on the Charlie Rose show, in which he's been going around hawking his book. And in the course of doing that, he's kind of maybe inadvertently let slip these little interesting tidbits about what's happening behind closed doors. And he said that the Chief Justice will wander down the hall sometimes and say, well, why don't you kind of join this narrow opinion so we can not have a 5-4. We can have something that appears to be more of a consensus decision. And now, I clerked at the court back in ancient times when Berger was Chief Justice. He was a pretty bad Chief Justice and very ineffective. But he never did anything like that. I mean, you would never see him trying to kind of muscle the court into presenting the picture of consensus where it had not existed before. And the fact that Justice Scalia is kind of publicly saying that the current chief is doing that and suggesting that he's kind of effective in doing that because he's so persuasive and you don't want to make him upset, that may actually go away towards explaining why we have 7-2s and 6-3s instead of 5-4s. So I think you got to kind of read the tea leaves where Justice Scalia kind of leaves them in the puddle as he walks down the hall. But it's interesting to try to read something into that.
I would just agree and add it's important to recognize that the justices as of 2 years ago, before the late Chief Justice Rehnquist passed away and Justice O'Connor retired, the justices had been together for 10 years. They'd been together for a long, long time. They knew each other very well. They knew which kind of cases they would be able to reach consensus on, which they wouldn't be able to reach consensus on. And they understood how Chief Justice Rehnquist worked, how he would assign cases, what he was trying to do. Then introduced two new people in the form of Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito. And I think we're seeing the court taking some time figuring out how they all work together. I think it may be a difference between this term and last term as to how Chief Justice Roberts is going about his job as he gets used to that job. It could be that, you know, where exactly does Justice Alito play out in some of these cases? Where is he likely to come approach different cases in different ways? All those questions, which by sort of 2004 we were completely familiar with all of the then sitting justices, now we're asking all those questions anew. And a lot of the cases we're seeing, I think, are the justices really becoming familiar with each other and understanding how they're approaching these cases, where coalitions are going to get together and when they're not. So I personally think it's a great improvement, the idea of having narrower decisions that are not 5-4, that are 6-3 or 7-2. I think that makes a big difference in accuracy. I think we see the court making fewer mistakes when it's less divided. And the fact that the court gets along generally, I think, on the whole, leads to better decision making. So I think we're seeing some positive steps forward, but it's too early to tell. It's very much a work in progress.
I didn't hear anything crazy, but one thing that interested me was Tom's perspective on whether the public's going to care about the Supreme Court this fall. Your instinct seemed to be that it wasn't going to be that much of a factor. And I'm no political analyst, but my instinct would have been different. It would have been that people do care, and maybe that's because I tend to know more about the Republican side of the aisle. But I think that there are still some cases coming out of the court that people are really upset about. I think Kennedy versus Louisiana is a really good example. Not just the outcome, because maybe it wouldn't surprise that many Americans that the death penalty would be limited to cases of murder, but some of the language in that opinion was very hard to stomach. For example, where it gave lip service really to the incredible harm and trauma on the victim. And I did a lot of work on child exploitation issues at DOJ, and so, you know, there's incredible harm there. It's really horrific, some of the sex crimes that are committed against children. So when you see language like that, it really, I think with parents across America, that kind of thing is just hard to take. I think on Heller, even though it came out the right way, so to speak, for people on the Republican side of the aisle, it's still the fact that the court was deciding that case shows that the court is important. It could have come out the other way. It was only decided on a 5-4 basis, and I think people will recognize the importance of the court for that reason. So those are my thoughts.
I guess I have two thoughts. One on Rachel's point, which I think is absolutely right in terms of people who read that opinion, people who are parents and concerned, and just how much that crime resonates with you. I just don't think anybody's read the thing.
That's true.
I will contrast that with Heller. From our website alone, 93,000 people downloaded the Heller opinion. Not from the Supreme Court's website, not from the millions of other places on the internets where you can get it, but from our website. And the fact that 93,000 people downloaded a Supreme Court opinion, I think is tremendous and fantastic, and is really one of the great things that I've seen relating to the Supreme Court in many years, that people would get that engaged and want to read the decision. I thought it was amazing. But on other cases, I think the public is, you know, basically, you know, Jan tells them what to think about the Supreme Court. The second thing I would say is there's another couple of cases that we haven't talked much about that really do go to this theme of the emergence of John Roberts' theory of jurisprudence and how he wants to guide the Supreme Court, and that is a pair of retaliation cases called Seebox and Gomez-Perez. Seebox in particular, I think, is a very significant decision when you want to talk about what the Supreme Court's going to be up to. Seebox is a case about whether or not there's an implied right of anti-retaliation right under Section 1981, which is the very old civil rights statute about discrimination on the basis of race in contracting. And every court of appeals applying a bunch of much more activist, one might say, interpretations of the civil rights laws, every court of appeals had recognized an anti-retaliation right in Section 1981 having been implied. At oral argument in the Seebox case, after the Supreme Court granted cert in the absence of a circuit conflict, at oral argument, Justice Scalia asked Paul Clement, you know, when is it that we stopped implying rights of action? When is it that we stopped letting the judges decide when you would have this claim and we made Congress say it? When did the bad old days end? And Paul Clement said, well, Justice Scalia, the bad old days ended when you arrived on the Supreme Court. But nonetheless, the Supreme Court in this case granted cert in the Seebox case and held that there is an implied anti-retaliation right in Section 1981 on the basis of stare decisis. And I think that a lot of people took that as a sign of an institutional commitment to stability. No one really believes that five members of the court would decide that case the same way if it were presented to them as an initial matter. But the court seemingly was poised to go the other way in the cert grant in the case, because this, too, is an issue in which Justice Kennedy had been in dissent, as in the constitutional cases that were referred to earlier, that the court had overruled last term. But on this statutory question, the Supreme Court said, no, we're going to let this area of the law stand, and did so by a 7-2 majority. And so I think that that's one kind of step that will by the Chief Justice who joined that opinion, that will encourage the members of the court on the left to be cooperative in this enterprise of trying to show less division.
All right. Do we have microphones? I can't. All right. Questions? Anyone? I can't tell if people are leaving. All right, here's.
How about a preview of building attractions and where the panelists think the court might go?
All right. All right, well, the preview, you know, whoever wants to jump in, I know Tom and Oren have kept pretty close tabs on that.
I mean, I can mention a few cases that are coming up that I think will be really interesting. The Supreme Court's going to tackle fleeting expletives. just in terms
what
of
what kind of expletives?
Fleeting expletives. I mutter something under my breath. And the FCC's response. The Supreme Court will be back in punitive damage land in a case I think that Charles's firm is doing yet again is trying to decide the scope of state power to impose or regulate punitive damages. So that'll be really interesting for the business community. There's another big punitive damages case. There's a case involving the ability to hold governmental officials liable in the context of the war on terror. And there, what we don't have right now is the one missing step, I think, in terms of overturning the Sandra Day O'Connor legacy in constitutional jurisprudence in sort of the 5-4 area. We don't have our really big religion case yet, in which the court says about the Ten Commandments decision, No, you don't understand, and turns that back around. I think that's the remaining leg of the stool. I don't see the court turning around on, for example, gay rights Because I don't think the big gay rights questions, you know, constitutional right of gay marriage is ever going to get to the Supreme Court in the next couple of decades. But in terms of reversing earlier precedent, I would think that that's the next big step to come. And so that would be the thing I'd most look for next term that hasn't arrived.
Yeah, and I would just add, my impression, Tom, I'm interested in if you agree, is that the court has taken a lot of pretty small cases. By and large, the cases that have been docketed so far have been sort of lawyer kinds of cases, not major high-profile. And there are a lot of them, a lot more than we've seen in past few terms, but not major high-profile kind of front page of the paper type cases.
Yeah, I mean, right now you don't have any blockbuster cases on the order of a Heller or a Kennedy in terms of the attention it'll have. I think Tom's exactly right that one of the areas where it may not be this term, but in coming terms we will see substantial change concerns the Establishment Clause. For better than two decades, it has not been much of an exaggeration as a matter of Establishment Clause jurisprudence to say that something was an unconstitutional establishment when Justice Sandra Day O'Connor found it to be an unconstitutional establishment. And for two decades, she stood precisely at the fulcrum of the court's First Amendment Establishment Clause jurisprudence. The one thing we surely know is that it is no longer the case that something is an establishment when Sandra Day O'Connor believes it is. And so I think it is an open question what the standards will be. The court has not had a significant case. If you look, for example, at the Ten Commandments cases, you had the Texas case, Van Orden versus Perry, that we litigated, and you had the Kentucky case, McCreary County. Those two cases split 5-4 going opposite ways, where the Texas Monument, we won 5-4, Kentucky lost 5-4. The vote that changed places was Justice Breyer. And so Justice Breyer voted to uphold Texas's monument, to strike down the monument in Kentucky. Interestingly enough, Kennedy was vigorously in favor of both of those monuments. And so an area of law where one could envision a change is precisely that, and it hasn't ended up at the court. And I think there's a broader point to be made that looking to the term a year ago, it was really quite striking how little precedential force was accorded opinions that Justice O'Connor had written for narrow 5-4 opinions, and it strikes an observer that there may be something of an inverse relationship between the opinions she had authored typically embraced balancing tests that looked very much to the facts of an individual case, that looked to judicial judgment, that didn't draw clear, bright lines. And the court, when there was a different collection of justices, was very quick to discard those. And it seemed that there's an inverse relationship, perhaps, between the power a justice exercises while on the court, because the value of a balancing test that depends on each case one at a time is that it puts that justice exquisitely as the decision maker, case by case by case, and yet it does not, it seems, leave a particularly strong jurisprudential legacy. If you contrast it, for example, I would venture to say both Justice Scalia and Justice Stevens will leave much more significant jurisprudential legacies, because each of them, in various areas of jurisprudence, have articulated clear, bright lines that are precedents that I expect, when both are gone, are likely to command greater respect from their successors than did the balancing tests that Justice O'Connor frequently embraced.
Well, that also, I mean, doesn't that show the difference in Justice O'Connor, whether she was powerful and that she was casting the key vote, or whether she was influential and that her opinions really had any kind of lasting force, which seems to suggest it was more the former. But Nelson, who clerked for Justice O'Connor.
Yeah, I don't disagree with anything that Ted said, but I would like to add one thing that I'm pretty confident that Justice O'Connor knew this at the time. And I think it's a mistake to think that and she's gotten a lot of criticism from people in the Federalist Society and conservatives and so on. But I think it's a mistake to assume, as a lot of people unfortunately did at the time she was on the court, that she was trying to maximize her power, and this is the way she did it. I think that I believe that's not true, and I think she had a different approach to the law than Justice Scalia, for example, does. And I might disagree with her on lots of things, but what was driving her, I do not think, was a failed attempt to be, a partially successful, immediately successful, but long-term failed attempt to be powerful. I don't think that was what she was doing.
Can I just say the one case that we haven't seen thus far get granted, but will be granted, and I think will be the big case of next term, because I don't think the detainee issue will be back yet next term, is Namudno. This is going to be the appeal from the 3-judge panel that upheld the extension of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act and its constitutionality. That, I think, is going to be a huge race case and is going to be the big divisive question before the Supreme Court next term.
And well, and a piece of that also, if I can chime in briefly, we have not seen very many federalism cases before the court. And one of the interesting differences, both Chief Justice Rehnquist and Sandra Day O'Connor were creatures of the states. They came from the states. They had a very personal and strong affinity with the states. Their replacements, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito, have both largely, for the bulk of their life, have either worked for the federal government or been in D.C. litigating in and around the federal government. I think it is still an open question because the cases have not presented themselves and the court hasn't seemed terribly eager to take the cases to see where the Roberts Court is on federalism. That's not an area the court has explained a great deal, and that was an area where O'Connor's views were relatively more conservative than Kennedy's. And so that could prove interesting as years go forward to see where exactly the court is on federalism.
Yeah, that is a very interesting point, which neither Chief Justice Roberts nor Justice Alito, when they were on the Courts of Appeals, ever had any opportunity to express any opinion on federalism questions. Justice Alito, I think, never got a paycheck from any employer other than the federal government. So, literally, unless he had a summer job that I didn't pick up on this disclosure. So, it's not at all clear that the court will continue. The court has been a little bit squishy on federalism questions in any event, but it's not at all clear where it's going to go.
Could we get kind of your bottom? I mean, just kind of stitching some of this together. When we're looking back now, the day that Justice O'Connor retired 3 years ago, what impact has the Roberts and Alito nomination in particular made on this court? I mean, obviously, we saw last term the abortion case, some of the race cases, and the one upcoming. But where would you say the nomination, particularly Alito, has really significantly changed the court in key areas or will change? I mean, cases that haven't quite gotten up there. If we could kind of just summarize, seems like we've...
Well, I think there are a host of cases in the past couple of years that you could imagine very likely coming out differently had, in particular, Justice O'Connor been on the court instead of Justice Alito, because I think by any measure, Justice Alito is a more conservative justice than Justice O'Connor was. And so, for example, if you look at the partial birth abortion case from last term, in which the court upheld on a 5-4 vote the Federal Partial Birth Abortion Act. I think it is a fair inference to say, had Justice O'Connor still been on the court, that case would have come out differently, and the Federal Partial Birth Abortion Act would have been struck down as unconstitutional. I think the Seattle race cases very easily could have come out differently, in which case you would have had a majority opinion upholding the use of race in admissions in high schools, and that would have been a very different outcome. I think there's a very significant possibility Heller might have come out differently. And I do agree with Tom, as we look forward to the 2008 election, by far the most significant outcome would have been if this 5-4 had been the other way around. I think that would have been a galvanizing issue in this presidential election of enormous force. And it's interesting to think, if Justice O'Connor had been on the court, I don't know where the court would have been. I know an awful lot of observers were less than fully confident how she would vote were the issue presented to her. So I think those are three big examples of cases that very possibly could have been decided differently.
I think what's interesting about the question, Jan, is that Justice O'Connor herself, I think, changed her views over time. So in the last few terms of her tenure on the court, she voted to just reduce it to a purely political left-right question. She moved to the left in the last three or four terms.
Before you go, I mean, and why do you see anything? What would have triggered that, or is there any explanation for why she would have started approaching those cases?
Or, and I dare you to say wisdom.
To say what?
Isn't there a wonderful wisdom book on the Supreme Court that talks about this question by Jan Crawford Greenberg? I do recommend
it. Yes, I highly recommend it.
You know, we can only speculate why that is, but I do think there was a significant turn, whether it was Bush versus Gore, sort of feedback from Bush versus Gore or something else. And it's interesting if you go back to the commentary on the Supreme Court around 1999-2000, it's all about this outrageously crazy right-wing conservative court, these five solid conservatives, these nutty, you know, Kennedy and O'Connor, oh my gosh, they're all so hardcore conservative. And then by 2004, Justice O'Connor's, I think, moved towards the center, and then it becomes, oh, look how crazy this conservative right-wing court is because we've replaced a moderate with a conservative. Well, it's not that clear to me that Justice Alito is that different from how Justice O'Connor had been. I think he's still more conservative than O'Connor of, say, 2000 or so. But the shift is not just the justices. It can also be, you know, within the individuals, I think.
I think that if you look at last term, the cases where people perceived the change in the law were ones where O'Connor and Kennedy had disagreed when O'Connor was still in the court. So a really good example of that is the partial birth abortion case. After O'Connor was no longer on the court and Kennedy was, you know, the swing justice, it should have shocked nobody that the partial birth abortion case came out the way it did. Kennedy's majority opinion in the case from last term was almost identical to his dissent in the partial birth abortion case from a few years earlier. And the race cases are similar. In the Michigan cases, you know, Kennedy was kind of on both sides of it a little bit if you take both cases together, but that's sort of an area where he differed over on the whole, I think, with O'Connor. And again, you saw a different outcome last year. On Heller, I'm not so sure. I think it would have come out differently if O'Connor had been on the court. It's impossible to know, obviously, because she was somewhat unpredictable, and you just never know. But she was from the West, and I think if anybody would have appreciated that issue, it probably would have been her.
Can I have just one category of cases, and that's gender cases? Mm-hmm. I think it was conventional wisdom that if you wanted to litigate a civil rights case in the Supreme Court when Justice O'Connor was on the court, it was better to litigate on behalf of a woman as a plaintiff than a racial minority as a plaintiff, because those issues, I think, did resonate with her. And so if you took the Ledbetter case from last term, for example, which was hard-fought, people feel very strongly on both sides, but there's an excellent chance that that case about Title VII pay discrimination would have come out the other way.
Yeah. Just to add one additional possibility in the federalism area, of course, O'Connor was a strong voice on federalism issues, and it may be the case that Justice Alito has somewhat different views, which we can see in the dormant commerce area, perhaps, but that'll have to play out.
Well, we're talking about Justice.
Are you? The cat had a question.
Oh, sorry. Question?
Mr. Kerr, let's say granted that Rasul would have suggested or anticipated or even entailed Bumadine, but can we have your sense of why that's even a tenable decision finally? I mean, I'm sure that George Sutherland, when we're recognizing the Soviet Union, you know, found it just untenable that we should be transferring the assets held by Russian nationals to Stalin's government. But he also understood that the judges could not take over cases in which diplomatic strategies involved with the military strategy, that if there's any principle running deep in the regime, it's that the safety of the American people cannot be put in the hands of officers, whether in parliament or in courts, who bear no direct responsibility to the lives of the people who are at stake. Now, the Wall Street Journal said that decision established President Kennedy ready to direct affairs on the military. But you've watched this pretty closely. Could you give us your sense of why you think that's a tenable decision, finally?
On the Boumediene case specifically, I think the precedents there were really actually pretty difficult to parse. They were old. They were written for a different era. The Eisentrager case, which is the primary precedent before Rasul, was just a disaster of an opinion. I mean, it is an incoherent mess. Very uncharacteristic of Justice Jackson, who normally wrote these beautiful, sort of very carefully crafted decisions. The Eisentrager decision is kind of all over the place. And I think what that did is let – I was not surprised that there are sort of ideologically consistent votes in that case, because I think if there's – if precedents are unclear, everybody sort of goes to where their instincts lie. If you sort of are on – you identify with either, you know, particular sets of views, you're more likely to be attracted to those views. And I'm not actually sure which was the correct answer in that case, but I don't think it was that clear. And I think it's, you know, similarly to talk the other case that I talked about, Kennedy versus Louisiana. I think Kennedy versus Louisiana was incorrect. I think Roper versus Simmons was incorrect. But I think that entire line of cases is really just is not a coherent, consistent body of case law that's really following any particular principles. So if you accept, though, that those prior precedents are in fact correct, I think these decisions actually become reasonably plausible. Not necessarily correct, but not quite as you know, sort of unreasonable as you're suggesting.
Let me, while we're talking about Justice Kennedy, isn't it, or it seems to me that the way to think about Justice Kennedy is that he will, I mean, you can kind of boil down his whole approach to the law is that he will never say never. So he's never going to say, you know, that he's going to overturn Roe and there's not a constitutional right to abortion. He's never going to oppose all race-based programs. He's never going to strike down the death penalty, though he's going to whittle away at it. I mean, could you guys just, how should we think about Justice Kennedy in terms of how he does approach these cases and how we may see him coming out? I mean, you guys have all talked about how these two, this term that he wrote, were pretty predictable.
You know, I think that's a fair point. I think I will speak for all the litigators on the panel who will say that we are unanimous in concluding that he is both brilliant and handsome. And not a one of us will utter a word to the contrary. That being said, I do.
And no fleeting expletives either.
That's a good phrase to work into your repertoire. Fleeting expletive. I do think a theme that can be derived, and it's consistent with Justice Kennedy's jurisprudence from this past term, is a theme of judicial supremacy. If you look across a number of the cases, if you look across Medellin, it was not accidental in the way Texas litigated the case. We didn't litigate Medellin as a federalism case, and we did so quite consciously. We litigated it as a separation of powers case. And the reason Texas didn't litigate Medellin as a federalism case is the narrative on the other side. The narrative that the 81 nations opposed to us, the narrative that the Department of Justice wanted to have, is, you know, there goes Texas again, defying the world, telling everyone to go jump in the Atlantic Ocean, and you know how those crazy Texans are about the death penalty. That's the narrative the other side wanted to tell. Now, if we'd come in and said this case is about federalism and the right of Texas to do what we want, that would have been a much more difficult position to defend. Instead, what we articulated, we said this is a separation of powers case. This is about principally the authority of the United States Congress in ratifying treaties to determine the domestic effect of treaties. And this is secondly about the authority of the Supreme Court of the United States. Because, and one of the fun things about litigating Medellin, how many times in your litigation career do you get to cite as a principal case you're relying on Marbury versus Madison? But that was front and center. We said, look, it is emphatically the province and duty of this court to say what the law is, not the world court and not the president in a two-paragraph memorandum. And at the end of the day, what the decision embraces is the proposition that it is the Supreme Court of the United States that will make the decision. That's the very same theme that animates Kennedy versus Louisiana. That at the end of the day, it is the Supreme Court's authority to make these decisions. Some might question, particularly in the Kennedy case, whether it should be the court. But I do think the authority, I think Boumediene is another example. Those are three cases where at the heart of what you're talking about is the authority of the courts, and in particular the U.S. Supreme Court, to decide significant questions affecting our society.
That's exactly the point I was going to make. If there's one thing you can predict, it's that Kennedy is going to be very skeptical of limitations on the court's authority, and I think that goes a long way to explaining Boumediene, some of the language in Kennedy versus Louisiana about the court's own judgment being important, and maybe his vote in Danforth also.
There are some justices, and I say this in the spirit of Ted's comment as praise of Justice Kennedy, but there are justices who fall in the Platonic Guardian school, and Justice O'Connor to some extent may have done that. And justices who don't, and I think Justice Kennedy falls on the Platonic Guardian side of the line, which I guess goes to say judicial power, defense of judicial power is a part of that. But I think they are justices who have, you know, a clear sense of their ability to figure out what's right and are willing to kind of put that into effect with less regard to what the elective branches have said, just as a psychological matter.
And Jen, in response to your question of trying to – what is the key to understanding Justice Kennedy? What I would recommend if you want to understand Justice Kennedy, how he might vote in future cases, this is not terribly novel, but look at his past cases. Read what he has said in the past. And I say that not only because that's generally a good piece of advice for understanding what a judge might do.
But Justice Kennedy is
remarkably consistent.
You think so?
Yes. I think he is remarkably consistent across time, even going back to his decisions on the Ninth Circuit. I think a lot of his style, his approach, his individual approach and individual doctrines is quite consistent across time. There are individual cases where his view will change, Roper being a case where he actually changed. Well, he was not on the court when the prior case was there. But I think he's actually quite consistent over time. And I think even though we think of him as sort of the swing voter, the justice in the center, he's actually quite consistent over time in what he does in individual doctrines.
So do you think he gets a bad rap because obviously the stories, they're so well known about, you know, him changing his mind after casting his vote and, say, you know, the Casey case, that they were kind of that frontal assault to Roe, or even that same term, Lee versus Weissman, when he changed his mind. I mean, so do you think that has kind of contributed to this storyline that he's kind of just bobbing around out there?
You know, if people really look at the opinions in the abortion cases, I agree with Orrin, at least with respect to the Atlanta cases, because in his dissent in the state-level partial birth abortion case, he seemed annoyed that the court had sort of rejected the bargain that had struck in Casey. So he was, at least internally, in his own mind, making efforts to be consistent with where Casey had been. And then, like I said earlier, his majority opinion in Carhart was identical to his dissent in Stenberg. So I really actually do think he's consistent in that line of cases.
I could supplement the point about Justice Kennedy's strong feeling about judicial supremacy. That may be connected with what seems to be another aspect of his approach to the law, which I think, actually, notwithstanding what Charles said, may be quite different from Justice O'Connor, for example. And it may also help to explain the tormented stuff that we've heard about things like Casey. He seems to be to have a very romantic or idealistic understanding of the U.S. Constitution, and that would help to explain, I think, why judicial supremacy is so important in his thought. And that's, I think, somewhat different from Justice O'Connor, who was not at all romantic. She was much more practical, much more like a common law judge. So I think this kind of deep emotional feeling that Justice Kennedy has about the nature of the U.S. Constitution may help to explain his stress on judicial supremacy.
And Orrin, I didn't mean to cut you off, and then Tom, and then I guess anyway.
I do think Justice Kennedy gets a bad rap In the following sense. This week was really interesting, or last week was interesting, to watch the commentary on Justice Kennedy, particularly on conservative law blogs such as the Vol Conspiracy or other sites. When Kennedy versus Louisiana came down, there was incredible anger and frustration, and how could he do this? And then I guess it was the next day or 2 days later, Heller comes down, silence. Well, wait. How could it be that That, now, on one hand, Justice Kennedy wrote an opinion in one case and not in the other. At the same time, I think a lot of the criticisms are really are coming from people who have very strong senses of what is right and what is wrong in constitutional decision-making. It's easy to write off somebody who you know you're going to disagree with. No one says, gosh, I can't believe Justice Ginsburg dissented in the Heller case. I think that's outrageous. How could she do that? It's just, if you disagree with Justice Ginsburg, the general view is going to be, of course, why would you discuss that? With Justice Kennedy, on the other hand, he's sort of the swing vote. Sometimes he's going to vote with the more liberal justices, sometimes with the more conservative justices. And so I think that does create sort of a different standard of how people view his decision.
And let me jump in real quickly on a comment Oren just made there, which I do think it is notable in Heller that there is an opinion for the court. It is a five-justice majority, and every word of it is the opinion of the court. There was not a concurrence from Justice Kennedy undercutting the force of that opinion. And I do think one difference, I think had Justice O'Connor been there, even if she had voted with the majority, I think there would be a much greater likelihood of seeing Justice O'Connor writing a concurrence so that what is given with one hand is taken away with the other. And I do think comparatively Kennedy is more willing to join a bright line opinion than O'Connor was.
One sentence before I know Tom wants to talk, but Oren, the reason people were so, I think part of the reason people are so outraged about Kennedy and didn't comment on Heller, it's not because of the vote as much as it is because of the language he used. I mean, that, and I keep going back to that, but really in Kennedy, that was a lot of it. It was just the sort of the language that sort of emphasized an arrogation of power, what people viewed to be an arrogation of power. So, sorry, Tom.
I just want to make clear that nobody loves Justice Kennedy as much as I do. I'll add a couple of additional thoughts. What we mean by Justice Kennedy as a swing vote is very different from what we meant about Justice O'Connor, who on cases where the facts were somewhat similar, so, you know, it didn't play out this way in the Ten Commandments case, but in other similar cases, say the Michigan race cases, right, where something she could be cutting a very, very fine line. And we don't mean that with Justice Kennedy. We mean he's the swing vote in the sense that on ideological questions, when you have a court that's 4-4 on the other side, somebody by definition has to be in the middle, and Justice Kennedy happens to be it. I don't think, while we do have lots of stories about him agonizing, once he makes up his mind, to Oren's point, he makes up his mind. So Lee versus Weissman comes along again, this is going to be an easy case for him. He's not going to struggle over it tremendously. Partial birth abortion comes back again. It's going to be, you know, take 2 seconds to figure out. The other thing that I would point out is in helping to resolve the anomaly that comes from just looking at Justice Kennedy's votes from an ideological worldview is he has a very strong individual rights conception of the Constitution, so that if you look at, for example, cases involving race and affirmative action, he doesn't believe people should be treated as groups, that you will be admitted to this school based on your race rather than your characteristics as an individual. Conversely, in the gay rights context, for example, he doesn't believe that people should be categorically excluded from what he regards as participation in the political process on the basis of their sexual orientation. He wants you to think about people as individuals, and that can produce results that are conservative or liberal, but from that, you know, perspective, he's actually very consistent.
All right. Well, I see our time, unfortunately, is up, but we will, of course, look forward to seeing you guys all back next year when we'll see what Justice Kennedy and the other eight do with these big cases next term. But thank you so much, and thank you again to Lee and Jean and the Federalist Society for bringing us all together.